Father, we thank you for, again, the safe journey you've given us. We ask your blessings on those who are traveling, those who are sick and not able. We thank you for the narratives that you've given us and that how you show us your character and who you are through the lives of others. And we rest in your promise that you are faithful and that you are one we can put our trust in. And we ask this through Christ. Amen. So tonight, hopefully get through Abraham's life here. We'll see. I think it's going to be tight on time. And then next week, we'll have kind of a, how does Abraham fit into the New Testament? Kind of a summary, trying to bring all of this together. And then the week after that, Phil will start up a new series for us. So tonight, class 9, the promise is secured. So Genesis 23 through 25. Again, just kind of a review where we've been. Genesis 1 through 11, we see rebellions. God's creation is good, but yet humans react to that negatively, decide to grasp instead of trust, and we have three rebellions that occur. Final rebellion being Babel, to where God disinherits the nations, exiles the nations, but calls one man as a part of this restoration process. He is called to be a blessing. He's called to leave his family. He does that. God promises him a nation, a great name. But immediately upon that, we see him grasping for his own wisdom and the famine in Egypt. Abraham then retraces his steps. Lot separates. So there's one possibility of the seed that is now eliminated because, again, a main tension in the story is who is the seed? From that, we have the promise restated, and then Abraham encounters the four kings and refuses the wealth from that encounter there. God then clarifies the promise. Abraham's trust is recognized as Zedekah, as a righteous act. We have the cutting ceremony to where God alone passes through the pieces, saying that he alone will bear the cost, in which this past weekend was just basically the culmination of that promise to Abraham, to where God bore the cost of that promise to secure it. And then you have the prophecy of exile. After that, though, Hagar is seen as a potential solution to the seed. The couple is renamed. It's told the heir will come through Sarah, and then we get this covenant sign of circumcision. And again, both the cutting of the pieces, that covenant, and the covenant of circumcision, I think, play into us for baptism, to where baptism we can look at as God's promise, that the promise is secure, and circumcision being a mark or a sign of the covenant. From there, three strangers appear to Abraham, and we see his hospitality. And from there, though, again, what I think is probably the hinge of the Abraham narrative, which is where we kind of get the triangle from. Abraham is charged to keep the path of Yahweh and to do Mishpat and Zedekah. And we talked about the tension that exists between those two corners and how often we kind of like to lean into one corner more than the other. And it may be situational that sometimes we may lean into the Zedekah, the mercy. Other times we may lean more into justice. But what God has told Abraham is there's a tension between the two. And true shalom does not happen if you completely ignore one of the corners. And he learned that in the narrative with Sodom and how even within Sodom, Abraham was encouraged to be an intercessor in that narrative. Lot is rescued, which again, the Sodom narrative really follows the flood narrative a lot. If you read through both of those, you'll see a lot of repetition, a lot of parallelism between those two stories. Even after that, Abraham goes back to his old ways of fear when he gets to Abimelech, and he lives outside the triangle that he prejudges, right? He prejudges Abimelech by saying, surely God's not in this place, but it's Abimelech who actually lives within the triangle and acts more with Mishpat and Zedekah. From there, Isaac is born, Ishmael is banished. So we have the son of the promise is born, and the son of the flesh is banished or told to leave. And then we have the covenant with Abimelech. We see Abraham living more within the triangle now. He's not grasping. He's living more. He's being a blessing. Last week we saw the test of Abraham. Again, the author was very clear to point out at the beginning, this is a test. And we saw God's character in that God does not want a human sacrifice. Instead, God provided, and God will see to it, is kind of the theme there. And the promise then is confirmed with an oath. So where we're going tonight will be Sarah's death. We've got to find Rebecca, securing the covenant future, and then Abraham's death. We didn't finish this last week, so we're going to kind of roll back just a little bit to the end of last week. So right after the ram is provided, Abraham looks up, sees a ram behind him. God has provided the sacrifice. And in here, and Yahweh's messenger called to him, some translations say angel, a second time from heaven and said, by myself I swear, declared Yahweh, indeed, because you've done this thing, have not withheld your son, your only one, indeed, I will bless you. I will make your seed many, yes, many, like the stars of the heaven, like the sand that is on the shore of the sea. Your seed shall inherit the gate of their enemies, and all nations of the earth shall find blessing through your seed, on the heel of your hearkening, or Shema, to my voice. So the angel calls out, and again, it kind of goes into first person. The angel is calling out to Abraham and then says, by myself I'll swear. Again, not sure, is this an angel that's talking on God's behalf? Is this actually God now talking to him? You can go either way with that. But notice what he says, by myself I swear. So he has already given a covenant to Abraham, to where he alone passed through the pieces. But now God swears upon himself that says, this covenant is secure, and I am making a promise upon myself. And that's what we see in Hebrews, right? Writer of Hebrews says, God, because he could swear by no one else, swore an oath upon himself. So when the Hebrew writer is talking about that, this is where he's going. And this should tell us, this is the faithfulness of God. This is his commitment to the promise. The promise that all nations will be blessed through Abraham. And again, this past weekend, we saw that promise fulfilled. The cross is God's fulfillment of that promise. And what we see is this right here. Because you hearkened or listened to my voice. And we talked about the testing here was a little bit of this melody that we've been hearing right from the tree of knowledge. The tree of knowledge is where God puts the couple in the garden. Are they going to trust God's wisdom? Eat from every tree you want, except this one. Or are they going to gain wisdom on their own? And we saw Eve listen to the voice of the serpent. Adam listened to the voice of Eve. Cain listened to his own voice. The people of Babel listened to their own voice. And throughout Abraham's narrative, we've seen him listening to other voices. But finally, with this test, we have someone who listens to God's voice. And we have to be honest and go, you know, Abraham had a whole bunch of reasons on those 3 days as he's journeying to come up with another voice. Right? I mean, God, you've said Isaac is the promised son. At my age now, it was Sarah's dead womb before, but it's really dead now. Abraham had a lot of other voices he could have listened to, but here the text goes out of its way to say, you have finally listened to my voice. Abraham is now basically, I think we can say, he's now living in the triangle. He is trusting God's provision and trusting in God. So right after this, what we would think climax, this high point of the story, we get a genealogy. And we've been through Genesis 1 through 11. I've had enough of the genealogies. So why a genealogy right now? Because it feels like a letdown. Now, after these events, what events? The binding of Isaac. It was told to Abraham, saying, here, Milcah too has borne sons to Nahor, your brother. And we get a listing of some of the sons. And then 23, now Bethuel begot Rivkah, or Rebekah. These 8 Milcah bore to Nahor, Abraham's brother. So there's a couple of things. One, it feels a little odd to have a genealogy here. 2, it feels even more odd to have Abraham's brother's genealogy here. I mean, we haven't heard of Nahor since chapter 11. Why are we getting his brother all of a sudden? And the third oddity, what's in the middle? A daughter. Very rarely in the genealogies through Genesis 1 through 11 is a daughter named. But here, there's an important point in the genealogy, and that's a daughter that is named. So when we take all of those oddities, we kind of go, okay, you know what? I think the author is giving us a hint. And he's saying, tuck this information away because you're going to need it later. With that, we close the Parsha segment, the Parsha Vayera, and he appeared. We enter into a new Parsha segment. Remember, the Parsha segments are simply the Sabbath readings. So as the Jews go through the Torah, Genesis through Deuteronomy, it's divided up 52, 54 sections. There's an intentional division. We're into the final section of Abraham's life, and it is the life of Sarah. And it's about the death of Sarah. So I go, that seems odd that for Sarah's death, we get Sarah's life. And it's odd that it's not the life of Abraham, because that's who we've been talking about. So there's an importance here. The New International Version, Sarah lived to be 127 years old. New English, Sarah lived 127 years. New American Standard, Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And I really thought tonight was going to be a nice, easy lesson. Get some caves, graves, and camels. But I've got to get through 2 slides here, and I'm really trying. So I ask for your patience. I'd love to take the New English Translation and go with that. Believe me, I would love to just take this and run with it. Sarah lived 127 years. Atta girl. Good life. But we have to look at the original text. This is how the text actually reads. Now Sarah's life was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. The years of Sarah's life. the author really slows us down here. And we can see the book ends about Sarah's life. And I think the author is saying, we've got to reflect upon her life here. This is a moment to really reflect upon Sarah and what her life was like. And notice the author has broken it down into seasons. We would say seasons, right? We talk about our seasons of life or stages of life. And if we reflect upon Sarah, we're introduced to Sarah with, now she was barren. And we recognize the pain that that's going to cause. But the author doesn't leave it with that, does he? He goes, Sarah was barren. She had no child. So the author reinforces the emotion and the pain that she feels. And that overshadows, I think, almost all of the Abraham narrative. The next time we get Sarah, her husband says, she's my sister. And she's taken into Pharaoh's court. And then Abraham gets a vision, and within that vision, God reveals that the seed will come through your loins. Sarah's not mentioned. And as Abraham shares that, perhaps Sarah thinks, maybe I'm not a part of the promise. Maybe it's just you, Abraham. So here's Hagar. Maybe that's the solution. And when Hagar gets pregnant, then the family dynamics change, the social structure changes, and now Hagar seems like maybe she's the primary wife, and Sarah afflicts her. And then we have Sarah behind the tent door, behind the tent flap, and three strangers are there. And one of the strangers says, next year Sarah will have a child. And Sarah hears that and inwardly laughs. And when she's called out of fear, she kind of denies that. And then, after it's been told, Sarah, the child will come through you, once again, her husband says, she's my sister. And this time, Sarah has to be complicit or feels compelled to say, yeah, he's my brother. Sarah's life has had a lot of pain. And as we reflect upon her life, we see a lot of pain that she's gone through. But then her son is born, and she names him Laughter. And recognizing the threat to the promise and wanting to make sure that the inheritance is not confused, she sends away the son of the slave woman. And then we really don't hear anything else. And we're left to wonder, how did Sarah respond to the binding? What happened there? And I just wonder if the way the author has framed this, I wonder, were the last 7 years, seven meaning complete, were those 7 years that Sarah finally got to rest in Shalom? Her life is presented in stages. And there's a long, long season of pain. And we honor Sarah at this moment. I think the author is inviting us to honor her. And for some of you ladies here, you've probably had an internal pain. And tonight, we honor you. Because you carry it different than we do. She died in Kiriath Arba, in the land of Canaan. Sarah was called out of her land too, from her family also. She could have told Abraham, "You go ahead." But she went with him, stayed with him, and died in the land that is promised. Told you, I wanted the NET translation. Would have been a lot easier. This slide I got to get through. So one way to go through the stages of life is to experience them in succession, to live each stage for what it is, and then to leave it behind and experience the next one. An alternative speculation, the way Sarah did it. You don't just passively travel through life stages, discarding the past for the more pressing priorities of the present. No, you build as you go. You take each stage with you as you encounter the next one. As you make your way toward the last stage of life, when the prospect of death starts to become more real, that growing awareness of life's end does not leave you feeling empty inside. Fear of that inevitable end does not become your sole obsessive focus. Why? Perhaps because the way you've lived life prepares you to leave life. You've lived with confidence to see death just as another stage that will give way into yet another, an ultimate stage whose mystery you ready yourself in your entirety to embrace. Paradoxically, when you confront death in that way, you feel more able to surrender your life when that day finally arrives to the one who created it. Maybe that is what it means to live an extraordinary life. David Foreman. This is the reflection that the author wants us to have. Abraham set about to lament or mourn for Sarah and to weep her. The first time in Scripture someone is mourning. And if we've been reading, we kind of are training our ears to hear, all of a sudden, this seems like a repetition, doesn't it? The author could have said, Abraham mourned for Sarah. That would have gotten the point across. Could have said, Abraham wept for Sarah. But here the author brings both words together. It's rare. David mourns and weeps for Absalom, but it's not quite in the same sense. Ecclesiastes says what? There's a time to mourn, and there's a time to weep. Ecclesiastes separates them. The author here brings them together because he wants us to feel the emotional weight, the solemnness, the gravity of this moment. Now we can go to the caves, graves, and camels. So with this next section, for us is an odd section. It is kind of like, what's going on between these guys? Because Abraham now wants a burial site. He needs to bury Sarah. So there's several observations that people have made on this, that this is just kind of an insight into ancient negotiation strategies and stuff like that. I think there's a real key here, though. Abraham first says, I'm a sojourner. I don't live here. But what I need I need a possession. And that's what God promised him earlier. God said, this land will be your possession. That's owned land. And Abraham here is asking for, in our terminology, he goes, I want a deed. I want clear title to this cave. And that's a pretty modest request, right? I mean, let's face it, caves aren't that productive. What are you going to do with a cave? So Abraham's request is a very modest request. And he goes, I give me title or possession to a burial holding among you so that I may bury my dead. And the sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying, hear us, my Lord. Hear us, my Lord. You are one exalted by God. So they've seen Abraham's life. And again, Abraham at this point, I believe, is living firmly within the triangle. He is being a blessing to others. In the choicest of our burial sites, you may bury your dead. No one will refuse you that. So right now we see there's a tension. Right? Abraham is asked for what? I want to buy the cave. Sons of Heth said what? Sure, we'll let you use a site. There's a big difference between owning and just letting them use it. So that's where the tension really becomes within this narrative here. Abraham continues to speak, and he says, here, interpose for me with Ephron, son of Tazor, that he may give me title to the cave of Machpelah, that is his, that is at the edge of his field, for the full silver worth, let him give me title. We look at the term give as a gift. That's really not what that term is meaning. He's wanting a transfer of ownership. This is not like, you know, it'd be nice if you could just kind of give it to me. This is an actual transaction. This is a sales process. It's not a timeshare. But he is asking for just this cave from Ephron. And Ephron says, and again, they're in the city gate. It's a public place. Not so, my Lord, hear me. The field I give you and the cave that is therein, I give it to you. So Ephron says, sure, you want to buy the cave? Absolutely. I'll sell you the field and the cave. What just happened? Abraham wanted to buy what? The cave. That's cheap. If you look at cave prices lately, they're still pretty cheap. Ephron says what? Yeah, I'll sell you the field and the cave. What happened to the price? Went way up. Yep. Abraham says, I'll give you full silver payment for it. And Ephron responds, well, what's 400 silver weight between friends? That's a lot. This was not a generous offering. Most scholars think that Abraham paid an enormous amount for this, for a cave. That's all he wanted was the cave. But what does Abraham do? He just weighs out the silver. There's no grasping. There's no negotiating. He is just living as a blessing in the land. And he now has a possession. And what we see, verses 17 to 20, we read this and we go, man, how many times do I have to hear about what the cave and the field looks like and where it is? There's just a lot of repetition in this. And the way I think we can see it is the first part is establishing the legal description of the property. It's telling, here's where the land actually is. The second part gives us that this is a public transaction. Everybody in the gates heard about it. So there's no question this is actually what's happening. What is the purpose for the land? It's to bury Sarah. And what we get then is a covenantal conclusion. Abraham finally has a possession in the land that he was promised. Remember, there's two components to the promise, main components, land and nation. They are intertwined. What good is land if you don't have people to move into it? And what good is a nation if you don't have land? So the two are intricately woven together. So right now, Abraham has secured at least a foothold in the land that God has said, this will be your possession. So now we've got the second part of the promise that needs some work done. We've got some land, but now that seed portion, that nation portion. We've gone along going, okay, who is the seed? And we know Isaac is the seed. But Isaac alone, it's going to be hard to make a nation, right? Isaac is going to need some help. Isaac's going to need a wife. So, Abraham was old, advanced in days, and Yahweh had blessed Abraham in everything. Again, that's a part of the promise that God made, right? I will bless you. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest, the one who ruled over him, please put your hand under my thigh. I will have you swear by Yahweh, the God of heaven, the God of earth, you will not take a wife for my son from my daughters. Putting your hand under my thigh is a euphemism. It's close. I'm glad we don't do contracts this way today. Handshakes are much better. But again, it has to do with the seed, and there is a there's just a symbolism there. And it's a very grave oath that's being taken, a very solemn oath. And he says, rather, go to the land of my kin. So now we understand why the author put that paragraph, that genealogy, in before. How did Abraham know where to send the servant? Well, he had already been told, okay, Nahor, he's got a granddaughter. Might want to consider her. So Abraham kind of knows this, and this is where he's sending his servant. So the servant, and is kind of saying, well, maybe she doesn't want to come. Not like you just show up on somebody's doorstep and saying, yeah, you would do. Can you? My master's son needs a wife. He goes, can I bring your son there so that he can meet her? And he goes, you will not bring my son back there. Notice he repeats it again. You must not bring my son back there. Isaac is in the land. And Abraham is not taking a chance that Isaac goes back to their homeland and stays. This is where they are. This is where God has promised them. And what does he say? Yahweh will do what? He will send his messenger before you. Again, could Abraham have come up with a whole bunch of other reasons and a whole bunch of other voices to listen to? What this shows us, again, Abraham is now trusting. He is living in a trust that says, I trust God that he will work this out. Let me go back one. Verse 10. The servant took 10 camels from his master and went. And we go, that's an odd kind of detail. Why would the author tell us exactly how many camels it took to make this journey? So we'll have to hang on to that. So the servant arose, went to the city of Nahor. He made the camels kneel outside the city by the well of water at the time when the women who draw water go out. And you think, this guy kind of is on the ball, right? I mean, if you're looking for a wife, that's going to be a good place to go. So the servant has gone to the right place at the right time. And he says he has a prayer to God. Yahweh, God of my master Abraham, please make it happen for me today and do chesed with my master Abraham. Here, I'm standing by a spring of water. The daughters of the men of the city are coming to draw water. Let it be that the young woman to whom I say, please lower your jar so that I may drink, and she says, drink, and I will also water your camels. Let her be the one you have appointed your servant. By this I will know you have done hesed with my master. Second time we've seen the word hesed here. First time was Lot talking to the angels, saying that y'all have done hesed towards me. But this time it's directed, saying, God, this is, I want you to do this. I want you to show a love that is not abandoning my Abraham. I want to see your covenant love, your loyal love towards Abraham. And he's not asking for this miraculous sign, is he? He's just saying, there's a character in the woman that we're looking for. Help me see that character. And what he's really kind of saying is, it's been a long journey. Could we knock this out on the first day? Instead of me waiting here at the well for another week. So he's asking God not for a sign, but just for a character test. And it was before he had finished speaking, here Rivka or Rebecca came out, her jar on her shoulder. Again, we get her genealogy. The young woman was very beautiful. She's a virgin, no man had known her. She went down to the spring, filled up her jar, and came up. The servant ran up to meet her and said, please, let me sip a little water from your jar. Jar's probably 3 gallons, roughly, just by archaeological estimates. Where is the spring? Downhill. So her jar goes to the spring downhill empty, right? Uphill full. And he asked for a sip. Can I just wet my lips? She said, drink, my lord. And she quickly lowered her jar onto her hand and gave him a drink. And she let him drink his fill. And she said, I will draw water for your camels also until they drink their fill. She hurried, emptied her jar through the trough. She ran again to the well to draw water and drew water for all his camels. And the man kept watching her in silence to know whether Yahweh had made his journey succeed or not. And it was when the camels had drunk their fill. He then gives her gifts. So we look at this and we go, have we heard this story before? Because what I think we see, what I think the author wants us to do is, the author has, if we were watching a play, the author has Rebecca and the servant on the screen. And she offers him not just a sip, but drink all you want. And then she says, I'll even water all your camels. And she hurries to do that. Where's the spring? Downhill, right? What did Abraham say to the three strangers? He said, you know, rest here. I've got a bagel and a cup of water. And what does Abraham do? Hurries to Rebekah, get 30 pounds of flour, make some bread. Hurries, kills the calf. Hurries, gets some yogurt and chocolate milk. Prepares this feast. So while we have Rebekah going down to the spring and coming back up, playing in the foreground, we've got Abraham playing in the background. This is the character of Rebekah. And for us, we may not be all that impressed, because for us, we haven't raised many camels. Why was this request a test of character? Because that's really what it was. This is, what kind of woman is going to be suitable as a wife for Isaac? There were 10 camels. Remember, the author let us know. 10 camels. They've crossed a desert. A single camel can drink 20 to 30, maybe 40 gallons of water after such a journey. Did a little math for you. 200 gallons of water minimum, possibly 400 gallons. 3-gallon jar, remember? Gallon of water, 8 pounds. 3-gallon jar, 25, 30 pounds. Where's the spring? Downhill. She's bringing over 200 gallons of water, or 1,600 pounds. If you go to 300, she's bringing up over a ton of water. Hauled uphill. For somebody you don't even know. And they only asked for a sip of water. This is Rebecca's character.
So were people stronger then?
I've got a 250-gallon rain barrel. And we've got some trees we bought. And by about the fourth 5-gallon bucket, I'm thinking a hose pipe is a sure is a better way to do this. I can't imagine emptying that reservoir 3 gallons at a time. And my land's flat. Walking, I don't know the incline. For somebody I don't know that just wanted a little Dixie cup full of water. This is true Zedekiah. This is restoring life. This is treating someone with dignity. This is creating shalom. This is an amazing act of for Rebecca. And notice it says it was until the camels drank their fill. So that means there's water left over in the trough. Because when a camel gets full, the camel doesn't look up and go, I'm good. You don't have to get any more. She oversupplied. And that's the generosity that characterizes the seed of Abraham. And who are we? The seed of Abraham. So what would it be if a church, an eldership, a staff, members, what if we had this generosity as a character, or as a way of life? I struggle with that. I'm not saying no man, go get a hose. Haul your own water for the camels. But what would this kind of generosity from a church do to a community? I think that's the reflection question that we have to ask upon this. He asked whose daughter you are. Again, we get the genealogy again. The servant said, blessed be Yahweh, God of my master Abraham, who has not withheld his chesed and his emet from my master. This is the first time these two words are paired together. Your most translations are going to say faithfulness. We're going to see it again in verse 48, that God led him on the emet way, the true way, and he's asking for the chesed and emet from them towards him. This pairing is a very important pairing in regards to God's character. We've already seen the chesed here as God's loyal love. And this other term is really his faithful truth, his faithfulness, his truthfulness. And it is frequently paired together. I tried to see, does it fit within the graphic I have? And I was like, no, but it is a supporting word. And it's a word that we do need to be familiar with. In Exodus 34, we've been here before, but God here declares to Moses, this is who I am. This is my character. And God says that he is merciful and gracious. That's the first pairing. He is slow to anger. And that's his response. How does he respond? Very slow to anger. Long suffering is, I think, the King James word. And then we get another pairing, abounding in hesed and emet, faithfulness, keeping his hesed for thousands of generations. This is what makes up God, this loyal love and this loyal faithfulness. We're not going to go over these, but again, I just want to show you, when we read through the Psalms leans very heavily into this pairing of words to describe God's character and to let us know who God is. So I just invite you again, we're not going to read them, but just, it was just a very quick, where are some words, some Psalms that show this pairing together? I'll let you do your own word study. Rebecca says to them, they ask Rebecca, will you go? And she says, yes, I'll go. So Rebecca is not forced into this decision. And you got to imagine, she woke up that morning, she's going, I'm just going to go get some water. And now all of a sudden, I'm engaged. So yeah, that's a shocker. So they sent Rebecca off with her sister and her nurse. They bless Rebecca and say, oh, sister, may you become thousands of 10,000s. May your seed take hold of the gates of its foes. We have this gate language here that we had earlier in God speaking to Abraham when after the binding. And he talks about the gates, that you will inherit the gates of your enemies. Jesus says what? Gates of hell will not prevail. So we have this kind of this language, this power language, and it's is this nation that Abraham is going to create, is it going to live by these principles? And through Jesus, Jesus does. And that is the church we are to become. Abraham said, God will go before you. And on the back end, the servant says, God has shown me his faithful love. This is from Walter Brueggemann. For it seeming like nativity, and he's talking about the Rebecca narrative here, this narrative is a mature reflection on faith. It asks people not first of all to anticipate the faithfulness of God, but to read it in retrospect. We do not always know the gifts of God in advance, but given a perspective of faith, we can in subsequent reflection discern the amazing movement of God in the events we had not noticed or which we had assigned to other causes. We don't always see God's providence, not in the moment. But as we look back upon prior events, we can kind of go, you know, I think God had a hand in that. And as we look back on the narrative of Abraham, I think that's really what Abraham's narrative is about. It's Abraham journeying through and looking back and saying, I see God's hand now. And that's really a reflection for us on how we live. Isaac and Rebecca begin their journey. There's a little humor there that she slipped down from her camel. Some versions say fell off her camel, and Isaac's just kind of out in the field. But it says this, he took Rebecca, and she became his wife, and he loved her. And Isaac was comforted after her mother. The second time the word love is used in the Old Testament. The first time, God says to Abraham, take your son, the one you love. And here, the son that is loved is now showing love towards Rebecca. And Sarah's influence is seen over this entire narrative, isn't it? Because even now, it seems like Isaac is still feeling grief from the loss of Sarah. But now with Rebecca, there's a comfort that he can have. And now the promised line is now being secured, because now Isaac has a wife. And we can see that that second part, the seed, we can see its future now. Abraham does remarry. His sons are listed. Verse 5. Abraham gave over all that was his to Isaac, and to the sons of the concubine that Abraham had. Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac, his son, while he was still alive, eastward to the east land. So before Abraham's death, he really sets things in order. That is shalom. That is making sure things are ordered and cared for. Isaac is secure as the promised seed. Isaac is secured as the heir. The other sons are sent outside of the covenant land. In the past, eastward was kind of negative, right? Cain went eastward. The men of Babel went eastward. Lot looked eastward. I don't think this is in a negative sense. It's not in that negative sense. But it is letting us know that it is away from the covenant land. There is a clear distinction that's being made between these sons and between Isaac. Now, these are the days and years of the life of Abraham which he lived, 100 years and 70 years and 5 years. Then he breathed his last. Abraham died at a good ripe age, old and sated with years. And he was gathered to his kinspeople. Again, the number is broken out. You can see it is different than Sarah. Again, I think the way the author framed Sarah was very unique. And we are meant to reflect here upon Abram, but not it's just not the same feel that I get as we had for Sarah. But God promised Abraham, you will die in shalom. You will die in peace. And here we come to the end of Abraham's life. He's had other children. He's had a good life. He is living with Mishpat and Zedekah in a sense of peace, in a sense of being a blessing that he was called to. And what do we see? We see Isaac and Ishmael reunited at his burial. We're not told how that happens. We're not told, is Hagar there? All we know is that the two brothers here, there's not an animosity, or at least they are able to come together for this moment in the death of Abraham.
Speaking of Ishmael, you know, back in 16, he's a wild man, and 17, 20. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you, behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall beget 12 princes and I will make him a great nation. What's your take on that?
Yeah, that Ishmael is Abraham's son.
Yeah.
So Abraham was promised that his seed would be blessed. So Ishmael does take part in that blessing of Abraham, because he is Abraham's son, but he is not the covenant line. So God fulfills his promise to Abraham, even outside of what I think God's plan was. He is still faithful to Abraham's seed. So yes, Ishmael was blessed. And again, if you read the banishment of Ishmael and the binding of Isaac, those two stories together, there is a covenant given. The covenant is repeated to Abraham after the binding of Isaac, and after Hagar sees the well, a covenant is reintroduced there for Ishmael. So we do see that, but again, it's Isaac that's the covenant line. It's Isaac that's the promised seed. So very good. So for our work, we are challenged to live each stage of life faithfully before God, as Sarah did, trusting that a life well lived can ripen into shalom or peace. We seek to refuse to grasp for what God has not yet given, And like Abraham, we learn to rest in the promise and act with quiet faithfulness. We can practice the kind of generosity that creates well-being for others, as Rebecca did for a stranger at the well. We can trust that God's providence is seen more clearly in retrospect than in the moment, but his loyal love and his faithfulness are no less real while we wait. So we've journeyed through Abraham's life. We've seen some highs and lows. We've seen what God's character is like. So next week we plan to kind of summarize this and then look at the New Testament and how Abraham is portrayed in the New Testament, how Jesus kind of looks at him, some of how Paul portrays him, and try to kind of tie all of this narrative together. So again, appreciate everyone's attendance tonight. Next week should not be very heavy. And I appreciate your patience with that. The narrative invites us in to experience and to feel the emotions that are there. And I think it's appropriate that we do, that we look at these narratives that God is saying, these are here for you to experience and to learn from. So with that, thanks everybody, and hopefully see you next week.
Thanks, Alan.